Session number 28933, Cyril Pierce, part 3.
Cyril, tell me some more about the reception centre at Lord's.
On the day that we reported there, it was early afternoon that we decided to go. I think you could report it there from 9 o'clock until a certain time, but we decided to go in the afternoon. And of course, while we were sitting, we had a very long wait, and there was a county cricket match going on, so we were able to watch that. Then of course we were billeted in those posh apartments around Regent's Court. These very wealthy apartments, and they'd simply evicted all the people, and we were billeted there. We only had billets to sleep on, the three cushions that form a bed, biscuits they call them, with mattresses, with blankets and sheets. And poor old Les Finbow, who won the George Medal, he got scabies from dirty blankets while he was there. We were, of course, paraded and marched everywhere. We should have had a great deal more marching practice than we actually did, my flight anyway. And of course, we fed in the canteen in the zoo, in Regent's Park Zoo. And we were near, we had to line up. We were near the gibbon's cage. You know, they jump from tree to tree and they go, woo, 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 noises like that all the time. We had to take our own irons, that's knife, fork and spoon, and then parade, get our lunch, and then, of course, there was the big bowl of water, which you dipped your irons in and shook them around and shook all the moisture off, and that was the wash they got, and then you put them back in your pocket and march back to the flight.
Cyril, who was it you actually joined up with from the police?
I joined up the people that I know from the list: Les Finbow, George Sharp, Harry Childs, Jock White, Paddy Murphy. And a bloke called Dix, who I went to school with, who was in a lower class than me, and he wasn't a scholarship boy. And I trained with him in the States. He was commissioned, and he came back into the Met Police, and he finished up as a commander. There are other people whose names are on my list who I don't ring a bell, but I might have known them, but I'm not sure.
But you came across police officers?
Everywhere that I was in the RAF, I met police officers. From the time that I joined, and there were a lot of police officers on that day, throughout all my training, throughout all my operational and my instructing sessions, I kept on meeting police officers. Even, as I say, to the, I think about a week before I was discharged, I met Harry Chamberlain up in Leconfield on 751 Squadron, and he had been a copper with me at Bow Street. So everywhere I met, and everybody who has done service in the RAF, in air crew, particularly in Bomber Command, between 1942 and the end of the war, will have met a policeman somewhere or at some time in that service.
So, tell me, when you finished Lord's, you went on to which ITW?
I went on to number 6 ITW at Torquay. Now, that was a 6-week course. We were a shower when we got down there, as far as marching was concerned. And so one of the first things that happened is we had a lot of square bashing, until by the time we'd finished ITW, we were classed as the smartest flight in the whole of the initial training wing. At ITW, you had to learn Morse code, aircraft recognition, RAF law and regulations, hygiene. You had to learn how to operate a Vickers machine gun. And there were, of course, constant lectures and constant drilling. I think that's all the subject I covered. Halfway through the course, you had to take the maths exam. And my friend Paddy Murphy failed that, and so he was just sent back, and he would have had to have gone back into the Met Police, because they were only accepting police officers as pilots and observers. And of course I never heard any more about him. We had to march from our billets to class lessons, and again every evening they had recapitulation classes, particularly in maths and navigation was, of course, the one thing I forgot to mention. And we had to be able, at the end of the course, where we had our final exams, the navigation exam had to be spot on for you to get your marks. And don't forget, as far as navigation is concerned, it's called the triangle of vectors. You're given a target. You can work out the course to your target as on the Mercator projections, which gives you, say, a course of 135 degrees. Then you have to, of course, know that the magnetic North Pole is not where the Mercator North Pole is. There is what is called deviation. So then you have to work out your course according to the North Pole, your magnetic course. Then every aircraft has got metal in it, and so every aircraft has to be swung to get the compass right to compensate for the metal in it. So your compass, your magnetic compass, because we only have magnetics, has to be right to cover the deviation caused by the metalwork in the program. So then you've got the course that you really need to follow. Then wind speed comes in. And don't forget that if wind speed, the whole mass of air is moving in one direction or another, and your aircraft is being taken with that wind, so you have to compensate for the wind direction and speed in order to get your true course. And this is what the navigation examination involved. You had to do all that so that you would then get on your true course. Don't forget that if you got your wind speed wrong, if, for instance, the wind was travelling 20 miles an hour from the west, then every hour your aircraft would be 20 miles further east. And if you didn't compensate for that, you would be 20 miles off your target by the time you got there. So all this had to be calculated. And again, there were a few people who failed on the navigation exam. They weren't given any second chances. They were simply posted back to the RAF, and what happened to them after that, I don't know. They could, of course, have volunteered for bomber, certainly not for navigator, and for wireless hopper or air gunners. When we finished that, I had applied. We'd all seen the commanding officer of the ITW, who'd interviewed us, and he'd had asked us who, when we were posted, we wished to be posted with. And I, of course, had said I wanted to be with George Sharp. The postings came through, and there was another bloke on the flight whose name was Pierce, and they had posted him with George Sharp instead of me. So I lost touch with George, but I stayed with Harry Charles and Jock White. Then we were sent to an acclimatation course at Cambridge Elementary Flying School to make sure that we weren't airsick and that we would be able, our mentality, our application would enable us to be a success as a pilot, because it's pretty useless if you try to train somebody who's going to be airsick or hasn't got the ability to do this. And anybody there who was that was washed off. After that, I was posted up to Heaton Park, which was a transit camp waiting for us to go overseas for training. At Heaton Park, we were allocated digs with an elderly woman who wasn't happy to see us because she said she'd been asked to be taken off the list. But anyway, she put up the four of us, that's Geordie Sharp, Harry Charles, Jock White and me. It was a bit of luck, this, because this woman's brother was in the Merchant Navy. And he had served on troop ships, and he, one evening we were then talking with him, and he said, you're told never to volunteer for anything in the forces, aren't you? And we said, yes. He said, well, a tip. He said, when you go on the trooper, he said, you've all got first aid certificates, haven't you? St. John's, I said, yeah. He said, as soon as you get on the troop ship, volunteer, make yourself known, tell them you are first aid trained, and then they will give you a little armlet, and you will therefore not have to do outlook on other duties. So as soon as we got to Liverpool, we went on to the Montcalm, the troop ship. Now the Montcalm was the sister ship of the Montrose, on which Crippen was arrested in 1912. So it was already 30 years old, this trooper. It had one big 6-inch gun at the back and a few little machine guns. We sailed from Liverpool, the Montcalm and another trooper, whose name I can't remember now, escorted out into the Atlantic for about 500 miles by a destroyer, and then we were left on our own. Now, I know ships like the Queen Elizabeth, no, Mary, the big, that was a troop ship, but it was so fast it could travel at 32 knots that it didn't need an escort. Now, these two troopers of ours weren't anything like as fast as that. But on the sixth day in the Atlantic, we met a force 10 gale. And on the trooper, of course, we were all in hammocks. Now, once you're taught how to put a hammock up, it's very easy to get into and out of. Now, you think as a hammock that you wouldn't feel the motion of a ship. But of course, it will only compensate for the roll from side to side, where the hammock will stay straight down. But it doesn't account for the pitching and the tossing. So the hammock suffers just as badly from any other form of bed on a troop ship as anything else. And in this force 10, now a force 12 is a hurricane. A force 10 is a very, very heavy storm. We had to reduce, we had to turn the ship, the two ships, in the direction it was coming from and reduce speed down to the lowest possible for safety's sake, to save it from capsizing. And of course, there was a lot of people who were very seasick. Now, we four coppers who were together didn't suffer from it. I think it might have been to the fact we were good beer drinkers. But none of us suffered. But these other people, one young lad I remember who was unfortunately killed in the States, his name was Wakefield. He was trained with me at ITW, and he was a bit dozy because we used to call him Wakey Wakey. He suffered so badly with seasickness that we had to call the doctor. And of course, he was hoping, he was so bad, he was hoping he was going to die. But it was a fortunate thing because the U-boats were out in the Atlantic. I don't think Ultra wasn't working then, as far as I can remember. But it wouldn't have made much odds, because with just two troop ships, you wouldn't have stood a chance against any sub. But the bad weather must have kept the subs under, because we had no problems. It took us 2 weeks to get from Liverpool to Halifax. I was never called to do any duty, except from the storm, when all of us who were so-called medical orderlies had to clear up all the spew that had been vomited by all the other people. At Halifax, we went to a transit camp, and it was there that I met again Geordie Sharp, who had been there about a week. I saw him for one night, and he was posted down to the States. And I was there for about another week, and then we were posted down to the Arnold Scheme, which was the Southeast States of America. We went from Halifax by train to Albany in Georgia, and it took 2 days. And of course, all the lights were on in the States. The first station we, oh, and they gave us, when we got on the train, a $10 bill as part of our wages. So at stops, the first thing that everybody did, of course, was buy bananas, oranges, which we'd never hadn't seen in England since the beginning of the war. Obviously, previous troop trains had been down there, so they were well stocked. They didn't run out. We went via New York, where I was able to get off the train, go out onto the main street outside the platform and have a look at the skyscrapers, speak to an American copper there, and then back on. At Washington, they wouldn't allow us off the train. They had the American MPs lining the platform, because Washington, of course, was full of civil servants, and most of them were women, and from previous troop trains where they'd allowed men off, they had been cottoned onto by the women who were not Toms, and they had disappeared for a couple of days, so that ladies could have a bit of fun with them. But they had these snowdrops, the American military police, stopping us from, we couldn't even put a foot on the platform. And then we went down to Albany in Georgia for acclimatization. There we were issued with American uniform, their tropical uniform, because all we had with us was the RAF uniform, and this was in the south, so we had to have their American tropical uniform. The only RAF clothing we ever wore down there was our black tie and our forage caps. Everything else was American, even underpants, pajamas. At acclimatization, of course, we had to get used to their food, because there was lashings of food, all served by Negro orderlies, and a grapefruit, fruit juice, full cooked breakfasts, including steaks, anything that you wanted. And we had to get used to that, because quite a number of people, of course, couldn't tackle this rich food, because their stomachs weren't used to it, particularly the youngsters, the 18-year-olds. Now, don't forget, I was 24 then, so my stomach was better acclimatized, so I was able to cope. We had to do American drill, marching to their orders, and at the first morning we got to the camp at Albany, at 6:30 in the morning, a full military band walks around the whole camp. Instead of sounding reveille, the whole band goes right round the camp. And of course there were us RAF shouting out of the windows, "Belts up! F off!"
What time would this have been, date-wise?
That was 6:30.
No, sorry, date-wise. When was it you were at this sort of stage?
Turnerfield, Albany, the 25th of January.
That was 42.
42, that's right. We got on the Montcalm on the 5th of January, 42. We arrived at Moncton, that's the transit camp, on the 20th. But we were in Halifax the previous day, which did give us a 14-day trip. Then at Turnerfield, we were there on the 25th of January to the 22nd of February. That was nearly a month.
And what did you do at Turnerfield?
We were acclimatized there, and we did the American, this was in Albany, Georgia, where we were fitted with the uniforms, as I just said. Then I was posted... The American Army Air Corps training scheme is in three phases. There's elementary, basic, and advanced. So we were sent. Are we doing okay for time? We were posted to Lakeland School of Aeronautics, which is in Lakeland, Florida. On the 23rd of February, 42. And we learned to fly there. I had already done 6 hours flying course at Cambridge on the acclimatization thing. But we started there. And
what aircraft did you fly on?
We were flying the Stearman, which is, of course, a beautiful aircraft, much better than the Tiger Moth, which the British were trained on. You can still see the Stearman if you go up to Old Walden. And if you have ever seen the two girls who are wing walking, they're on Stearmans, and they're all wartime Stearmans. At the end of the war, I've since learned that there were so many Stearmans because all the US Army Air Corps, there was no US Air Force in those days, all the US Army Air Corps, all the US Naval Air Corps, all the US Marine Air Corps all had their own flying divisions, and they all trained on Stearmans. They got them up in Canada, and so there were a lot of Stearmans, and at the end of the war, you could have bought a Stearman for $200. The rate of exchange at that time was $4 to the pound, so you could have bought a steerman for 50 quid. You know how much I saw, how much the last one I saw? I get RAF, the aeroplane and fly past magazines. The last one I saw in there was a special naval steerman, which had all sorts of things on it. But the actual asking price for that was $180,000, which is about £140,000. I do, with the Arnold scheme, I go to Old Walden, where we have at least, this is once a year, where we have at least 10 steermans, several Harvards, which I trained on, and they're all owned privately. We're not allowed to have any trips in them, but we meet the pilots, of course, and, oh dear, Alan, one famous television star owns one of them, Martin Shaw, and he's always there with his girlfriend, and we see him. So there's still a lot of steermans about, but by God, if you want one now, you've got to pay for it. Now, I'm still at Lakeland, aren't I, on steermans. We had to do 70 hours, and we had to, and this was the elementary school was staffed by civilian instructors and a few RAF instructors. You had to solo within 10 hours. If you didn't, you were washed out or eliminated, as the Americans called it, a washout. I soloed in 6 hours, so I was all right. The Stearman, as I say, was a wonderful aircraft to fly. And it had brakes, which a tiger moth doesn't have. You didn't know that, did you? A tiger moth has no brakes. So it's a bit of a job stopping them. But it did have brakes, the steerman. We got on very well with all the American servicemen who were ground crew. Then we were posted to basic flying schools. Now, the point was, there were... six elementary schools, then basic, there were two basic flying schools, and then five advanced flying schools. So you could be split up, and this is where I lost all my friends, because we were split up. I was on my own from leaving Lakeland when we were posted to our basic course on Vultees, which were monoplanes with flaps, two-speed props and fixed undercarriage. There I had to do another 6 weeks, and you had to do 60 hours. You had to solo there within 6 hours, because you'd already got a lot of time on the steerman. And then from there I was posted up to Dothan in Alabama to fly on Harvards on their advanced flying course. And there's a picture of a Harvard in there somewhere. At basic and advanced schools, we had to mix with the American pupils, or, yeah, that's right, cadets, that's the word I want, with the American cadets. Now, all the American cadets were, of course, high school, college boys who were going to make their career in the Air Force. And they were all going to be commissioned. And they tried to have the West Point discipline at these flying schools, which is idiotic, because you have to sit to attention. You're not allowed to eat your food until you're told to. At the basic school we were at, we had cloth American flying helmets. They're simply like an ordinary flying helmet, except it's made of cloth with the earpieces on. And you were supposed to march down to flights, wearing them inside out until you'd soloed. Now, there were a lot of coppers on this course I was on, and at the same time there were quite a few servicemen who had managed to transfer from the army into the Air Force to fly, and we were all ballsy and we refused to do this.